Welcome. Now, our first question, 1 + 1. Yes.
2.
Incorrect. Yes.
Multiculturalism.
Well done, Simon.
Next question, what is 3 × 3? Yes?
9.
Wrong. Yes, Penelope.
Gender equality.
Very good, Penelope.
Is this a joke?
You think gender equality is a joke?
No, but isn't this a maths class?
Don't be so racist.
I just asked a question.
We don't ask questions. Questions are offensive.
Yeah!
Now, students, I trust you've all completed your research assignments. And remember, the person with the highest mark will be flying to New York to present their paper at the World Mathematics Summit. Well done, Penelope. 6 out of 10. You too, Simon. 6 out of 10.
Hey. Be careful. You've been staring at her for 10 seconds.
What?
It's a form of harassment to stare at a woman for more than 15 seconds straight. And when I use the term straight, I don't mean to offend any persons of a non-traditional sexual preference. And when I use the term non-traditional, I don't mean to offend any persons who oppose historically normalized...
Okay, I get it.
Unfortunately, Sunshine, your research assignment is only worth a 1 out of 10.
I've used Fourier transform and mathematical methods in electronics to analyze the electrodiagrams of at-risk patients and calculate their risk of experiencing a heart attack. I mean, it's a new method, but it could potentially save thousands of lives.
7.
You barely even read it.
You used red pen.
What?
Red is considered offensive in many religions.
Why would you belittle everything down to a singular color? Well, humanity is a rainbow of beauty and spirituality.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. 7 out of 10, but that still means I get to go to the summit, right?
The marking process isn't over yet. Now, because we live in a society based on equality, the total amount of marks are to be divided equally among our students.
You've got to be kidding me.
Well done, students. We're all equal. We're all average.
Yay!
But then who gets to go to the summit?
Oh, we haven't added our privilege points yet. Don't you know anything?
That is correct.
Aw, come on, Brett. That's absurd, you might say. There's nothing that ridiculous happening in the real world. Well, I agree. But in many important ways, academia isn't part of the real world. And when it comes to ridiculousness, many students and professors are demonstrating that they refuse to be outdone by satire. Here we go.
Wash away my troubles, wash away my pain with the rain and jambalaya. Wash away my sorrow, wash away my shame.
This is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is September 9th. Before we even get started today, I don't know what's going to happen. Sometimes you just get inspired and you hit record on your little recorder. Whew, this could be a messy one. But before we get to all that, I want to extend a warm konnichiwa to some new listeners. My friend John, who's been an important advisor for the School Sucks Project, he said to me recently, "Hey, Brett, you got to get your podcast on Google Play." I said, "Google Play? Sure, why not?" So I go ahead and I submit the podcast. In the last 5 days, we've had over 200,000 feed views, and there is a spike in downloads as well. So it's very possible that there's some new folks checking out the show. If you are one of those folks, My recommendation is to go to schoolsucksproject.com and just survey the area a little bit. Maybe there's something specific that you're looking for. It's going to be hard just scrolling on your phone through hundreds and hundreds of podcasts. So in our main navigation menu at schoolsucksproject.com, there's a little dropdown. It's called Pod Classes. You know, it's like a play on the word podcast, but with like a education theme. Adorable. So there, most of our content is organized into themes. And there are some general themes like critical thinking, better communication, history and philosophy, psychology and wellness, school issues, and self-sufficiency. And within those, there are collections of podcasts, like individual series. So if you're looking to learn something specific, that might be something worth checking out. There's also, if you're looking to do your own independent study, there's a resource section with a variety of different subject areas. And I'm glad to have you on board. I hope you continue to listen. So anyway, we have been dipping our toes recently on this show into some of the most exciting and frustrating political controversies of the day. My show with Jeffrey Tucker on the alt-right, my current series with Julia Toyanskaya on gender, sex, and sexuality issues. But what has inspired my interest in that particular topic is the broader social justice conflict really taking place in an arena that we here at the School Sucks Project should be paying attention to, and that is quote-unquote higher education, college. So I have booked a guest. She's coming on the show next week. She is a controversial figure. Her name is Christina Hoff Summers. On YouTube, she is known as the Factual Feminist. She is an academic, and she is currently a contributor at the American Enterprise Institute. A lot of people do not like this lady. When she goes places, they shout and throw tantrums. And I have this desire to have this conversation with her, not just to get her thoughts on some of the stuff I've been talking about with Julia, but also to kind of get a report from the ground, because she goes to these colleges and talks to these students. So that's coming up sometime next week. I'm currently in the process of doing research to prepare for that show, and I happened to stumble across an opinion piece from the Harvard Crimson. That's Harvard's student newspaper that I need to share with you. Even though it's 2 years old, I cannot believe this did not come up on radar. Didn't really even seem to generate as much controversy as it should have at the time. Now, some of you might be saying, Brett, the Harvard student newspaper, what do you care what those nitwits think? Oh, that's a good question, but Harvard is one of the top schools in the country. The opinions of the students therein, I think, can act as a very important barometer for the condition of higher education. Not only are trends set in academia by Harvard University, but student opinions also reflect the pedagogy and the ideology of Harvard professors. And if these types of opinions have become perfectly acceptable and perfectly commonplace, as they have, I mean, this was 2 years ago. When you look at, well, I'm going to read this to you, and you think about what's developed at schools like Harvard and Yale and Dartmouth over the course of the last couple of years, it's very, very troubling. So a student named Sandra Korn, class of 2014, joint major in the history of science and studies of women, gender, and sexuality, penned a piece composed of thoughts that she decided, given Harvard's discursive climate at the time, were perfectly acceptable to utter aloud. The title, The Doctrine of Academic Freedom. Now, I'm going to read the whole thing. It's not going to take that long. And then you better believe we're going to discuss it. We'll see if I get through it or not. In July 1971, Harvard psychology professor Richard J. Herrstein penned an article for Atlantic Monthly titled IQ, in which he endorsed the theories of UC Berkeley psychologist Arthur Jensen, who had claimed that intelligence is almost entirely hereditary and varies by race. Herrstein further argued that because intelligence was hereditary, social programs intended to establish a more egalitarian society were futile. He wrote that, quote, social standing is based to some extent on inherited differences among people. So what an exciting start. And it's interesting that this is how Sandra chooses to build momentum for herself, right? By citing the work of Richard Herrstein, who had the audacity to claim in 1971 that social programs intended to establish a more egalitarian society were futile. Wow, look at all the egg on his face in 2016. That's sarcasm. Now, there's plenty of arguments as to the cause. I mean, I think you could argue that these social programs failed because that's what government programs that intend to help people ultimately do. But it's interesting that she decides to lead with this. Let's see where she goes next. So, again, referencing Herrnstein, paragraph 2. When he returned to campus for fall semester in 1971, Herrnstein was met by angry student activists. Harvard Radcliffe Students for a Democratic Society protested his introductory psychology class with a bullhorn and leaflets. They tied up Herrnstein's lectures with pointed questions about scientific racism. Students for a Democratic Society even called for Harvard to fire Herrnstein, along with another of his colleagues, sociologist Christopher Jenks. So, so now I see a protagonist emerging in this story. As far as the author, Sandra Korn, is concerned, the Students for a Democratic Society, who didn't see any problem with undermining the educational experience of all of the students in Herrnstein's psychology class. And we don't even know if what he wrote in Atlantic Monthly on IQ factored into his teaching. But we have this composition fallacy of, and what he wrote, like, I'll put the abstract for IQ. You know what? I'm going to pause, and I'm going to read you the abstract of this paper that led to the Students for Democratic Society protest. September 1971, IQ by Richard Herrnstein. And this will just speak to the sensitivity, the mass sensitivity of the Students for Democratic Society, or just the mob mentality. It was a time of protest. So was there a lot of critical thinking about everything that was being protest, or were people just so easy to mobilize because of the climate at that time? You know, you had civil rights, you had Vietnam. Maybe some people just said, okay, hey, we're going to another protest, and people went along. That's all speculation. We don't know. But here's the abstract for this article, this catalyst that led to this mass disruption and the undermining of the educational experience for all other students in Herrnstein's class back in 1971. IQ by Richard Herrnstein. Classlessness is elusive because people vary and because they compete for gain, economic and otherwise. All right. Well, I mean, if you are, Students for Democratic Society or even a leftist today, bad opening. Classlessness is elusive. Competition? Ugh. Where's my markers and my poster board and my sticks and my staples? It's what you need to make a sign. The tendency to respect, honor, remunerate, and perhaps even envy people who succeed is not only ingrained, but is itself a source of social pressure to contribute to one's limit. The premium given to lawyers, doctors, engineers, and business managers is not accidental, for those jobs are left to incompetence at our collective peril. There are simply fewer potentially competent physicians than barbers. The gradient of occupations is, then, a natural measure of value and scarcity. And beneath this gradient is a scale of inborn ability, which is what gives the syllogism its unique potency. It seems that we are indeed stuck with the conclusion of the syllogism. The data on IQ and social class differences show that we have been living with an inherited stratification of our society for some time. Now, if this man... See, much of the science that he cites then might be thrown out today. But if he is setting up a prediction that further attempts to establish equality in society will not work, what kind of crystal ball did he need in 1971 to warn that government programs to establish equality would only increase stratification in society? And again, a lot of that racialist science that is this old, that comes from the 1960s and 70s, if not before, if not the 19-teens and 20s, that race realists like to cite, a lot of it is highly questionable today. But the prediction is interesting, right? So it's neat to be able to go back 45 years and look at somebody who is trying to make warnings about policy that will exacerbate problems that the left claims they want to solve, shouted down and threatened with the loss of his job. But I continue. The opportunity for social mobilities around classes assures the biological distinctiveness of each class. For the unusual offspring, whether more or less able than his or her closest relatives, would quickly rise above his family or sink below it, and take his place, both biologically and socially, with his peers. If this is a fair picture of the future, then we should be preparing ourselves for it instead of railing against its dawning signs. Greater wealth, health, freedom, fairness, and educational opportunity are not going to give us the egalitarian society of our philosophical heritage. It will instead give us a society sharply graduated, with even greater innate separation between the top and the bottom, and even more uniformity within families as far as inherited abilities are concerned. Naturally, we find this vista appalling, for we have been raised to think of social equality as our goal. The vista reminds us of the world we had hoped to leave behind: aristocracies, privileged classes, unfair advantages, and disadvantages of birth. But it is different, for the privileged classes of the past were probably not much superior biologically to the downtrodden, which is why revolutions had a fair chance of success. By removing arbitrary barriers between classes, society has encouraged the creation of biological barriers. When people can freely take their natural level in society, the upper classes will, virtually by definition, have greater capacity than the lower. Herrnstein, that name also might be familiar to some of you because he stuck with this for a long time. In the early 1990s, he wrote a book with Charles Murray called The Bell Curve. This has definitely been a subject of discussion, I know, at least on Free Domain Radio, but maybe on some of the other shows you listen to as well. Now, without veering into an entire analysis of that, which honestly, I'm really not even prepared to do, one of the caveats that I would enter in and go and do your own homework if this is a subject that interests you, but it's not something I want to devote a ton of time to here. The caveats about Herrnstein's research is that it is largely rooted in behaviorism. So there's lots of aspects of the human intellectual and emotional and relational experience neglected from the studies that he did, mostly in the 1970s. So just a quick example of this would be a lot of the work that Herrnstein was doing at the time depended heavily on measurements of success. And Herrnstein's interpretation of success had much more to do with social standing, something that is very, very measurable. Remember, this behaviorism versus happiness. So with this original research, where IQ was also the only measurement of intelligence, there's a lot of assumptions that Herrnstein makes, it seems, or a lot of his own definitions that you have to buy into to keep going with some of his research. But that being said, plus me, your humble narrator, not putting a lot of stock into what he was doing in the early 70s, I don't know how well that was fleshed out in The Bell Curve 20 years later. I did actually have a bunch of notes that I made in my Evernote in preparation for doing Red Ice Radio on the subject of IQ. But like I said, I'm not fully prepared to talk about this right now. Just a little elaboration of Herrnstein's work at the time. It was, for sure, way more complex than whites are better than blacks, which is how it ultimately and essentially gets painted by Students for a Democratic Society. So that's like a slight elaboration of what Sandra Korn is referencing in this piece that I started to read called The Doctrine of Academic Freedom. I'm sorry I lied to you and said I was going to read the whole thing through first without commenting on it. That hasn't worked out, has it? We're only two paragraphs through. So we pick up, now having that information added, we pick up the third paragraph. Herrnstein told The Crimson, quote, "The attacks on me have not bothered me personally. What bothers me is this. Something has happened at Harvard this year that makes it hazardous for a professor to teach certain kinds of views," unquote. Now listen to this fucking sentence that this girl writes. This, Herrnstein seems to have not understood, was precisely the goal of the SDS activists. They wanted to make the certain kinds of views they deemed racist and classist unwelcome on Harvard's campus. I put strong emphasis on the words they deemed, and we are coming back to that. Harvard's deans were also unhappy. They expressed concerns about student activists' interference with the academic freedom and right to speak of a member of the Harvard faculty. Did SDS activists at Harvard infringe on Herrnstein's academic freedom? The answer might be that yes, they did, but that's not the most important question to ask. Student and faculty obsession with the doctrine of academic freedom often seems to bump up against something I think much more important. Academic justice. Kabam. I added the kabam. And folks, justice is going to be the focus, I think, of our examination here today. But let's continue. In its oft-cited Statement of Principles on Academic Freedom and Tenure, the American Association of University Professors declares that, quote, teachers are entitled to full freedom in research and in the publication of the results, unquote. In principle, this policy seems sound. It would not do for academics to have their research restricted by the political whims of the moment. Yet the liberal obsession with academic freedom, she puts that in quotes, seems a bit misplaced to me. After all, no one has, this is in quotes again, full freedom in research and publication. Which research proposals receive funding and what papers are accepted for publication are always contingent on political priorities. The words used to articulate a research question can have implications for its outcome. No academic question is ever free, in quotes again, from political realities. If our university community opposes racism, sexism, and heterosexism, pause to look up heterosexism. Sorry, I'm learning a lot of new words from looking into these people. All right, so surprise, it's not a real word. Add to the search, heterosexism definition. Heterosexism is a system of attitudes, bias, and discrimination in favor of opposite sex sexuality and relationships. Oh, okay. Well, I should have known that. I'm sorry. It can include the presumption that other people are heterosexual or that opposite sex attractions and relationship are the norm and therefore superior. So it's like gender normativity applied to sexual orientation. No academic question is ever free from political realities. If our university opposes racism, sexism, and heterosexism, why should we put up with research that counters our goals simply in the name of academic freedom? Instead, I would like to propose a more rigorous standard. Rigorous, she says. One of academic justice. Well, okay, it's interesting that she says more. She says more, and we're going to read it. But rigorous standard, okay? Justice is one of the most nebulous words in our language, certainly in the philosophical conversation. Example, how would you like to hear a debate between Jeffrey Tucker and Chris Cantwell on what justice would look like and their ideal concept of society? Do we have enough building materials to make that bridge? I don't even think so. Now, on the other hand, unless you're like North Korean, the perversion of the word freedom, it can only go so far. The government in the United States of America is getting away with a pretty substantial perversion of that word right now. But justice is even more cloudy. And the thing is that justice needs to be enforced. So it becomes entirely dependent on the wishes and the whims of those people who have the conviction and the energy. Maybe we should call it the obsession to patrol the internet and college syllabuses and mainstream media for any whiff of injustice. People who are also incentivized to make sure that injustice is never fully stamped out because then they have no purpose anymore. But this senior at Harvard University, Sandra Korn, has an attitude that a lot of people in her position have, a lot of people above them in the role of professor or assistant professor have, is that what they believe is objective. And that everything else, that everything that is dissenting or that runs against their beliefs, I mean, there is actual justification for this, right? We are the smarts. This is the adult table. Anybody who says things that contradict what we say, those are ideologies, and because they are inferior, they can be marginalized. And it's a slippery slope. It starts with things that I think like standards as far as like racism or sexism that most decent people would agree on. This is racist, ABC. This is sexist, ABC. You'll get along better if you avoid these types of thinking. These types of speech or types of thought are clearly defined. But that's not the case when it comes to the guardians of justice. They are like the unionized toll booth workers of academia. There is always going to need to be some justification for their job to exist. So those definitions, those finite definitions of racism and sexism, things that are really legitimate, like obstacles, roadblocks in a person's thinking or to a person's opportunity or to a person's relationship, those things that should be finite definitions, they're always on the expand. Today, there are no limits. Where was I? Justice. So let me just take the last paragraph again. I'm so sorry, folks. Instead, I would like to propose a more rigorous standard, one of academic justice. When an academic community observes research promoting or justifying oppression, it should ensure that this research does not continue. These are the lessons of Vladimir Lenin, folks, promoted at Harvard University. Because all that has to happen, and we're seeing it happen, if something bumps up against a leftist political, economic, educational, social ideology, out comes the name tag that says promoting or justifying oppression, and it's slapped on. It's getting that easy. This was written just over 2 years ago. I wonder if Sandra Korn knew this, how easy it was going to be. Continuing, the power to enforce academic justice comes from students, faculty, and workers organizing together to make our universities look as we want them to do. 2 years ago, when former summer school instructor Subramanian Swamy published hateful commentary about Muslims in India, the Harvard community organized to ensure that he would not return to teach on campus. So, summary of that sentence in Sandra Korn's world. Had a hateful guy here a couple years ago, but the guardians got together and we got rid of him. High five, high five, high five. That's 30 words, right, that I just read. There is so much to unpack there. Let me read it again. 2 years ago, when former summer school instructor Subramanian Swamy published hateful commentary about Muslims in India, the Harvard community organized to ensure that he would not return to teach on campus. Now, we talked about how this is just used in the article to set a precedent. Already solved. This problem already solved. We're building on this for the future. But now, time for an adventure. First from FIRE. This is Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, an organization that we've talked about before. From their case files, Harvard University, professor fired for newspaper column. On July 16th, 2011, in response to a terrorist bombing in Mumbai, India, Harvard University economics professor Subramanian Swamy published a critical column in the Indian Daily News and Analysis newspaper. Swamy's controversial column offered ideas on how to negate the political goals of Islamic terrorism in India. And I'm going to paraphrase a little bit here. He was talking about removing mosques, 300 of them, near temple sites. In response, several Harvard students circulated a petition demanding that Harvard terminate Swamy's employment. Harvard Summer School Dean Donald H. Pfister initially said that Harvard would give the case serious attention, prompting a letter from FIRE, the organization. Harvard administrators took no further action, but in December of 2011, Harvard's Faculty of Arts and Sciences voted to cancel Swamy's scheduled summer 2012 courses, with multiple faculty members claiming that Swamy's column was hate speech and incited people to violence. A little more. This from the left-leaning Boston.com. Pushed out of Harvard, professor returns fire. Dismissal stirs debate over free speech. January 2nd, 2012. Subramanian Swamy is an outspoken man. That's what got him into trouble last July. While teaching economics at the Harvard University Summer School, he penned a sharply worded column for a newspaper in India, where he is a prominent right-wing politician. A word that we would apply to many of his views in this country, folks, would be nationalist. Many readers thought his proposals would deny Muslims basic rights and incite riots. Some 40 Harvard professors called for his dismissal. But the furor died down, or appeared to, after a Harvard statement defended Swamy's right to free speech as central to the mission of a university. The economics department invited him back for another summer. Swamy heard nothing else from Harvard. Then, a few weeks ago, he checked his email and learned from a Google alert for his name that his colleagues had fired him anyway. Encouraged by a private note from the summer school's dean, professors who opposed Swamy came to a faculty meeting where summer classes were to be approved. The process is usually a rubber stamp affair, but the professors argued so passionately that Swamy's courses were voted off the slate. No one told Swamy about the meeting. Now the case has devolved into an imbroglio about hate speech and academic freedom. The professors who led the charge against Swamy are buried in angry emails from his supporters in India. Others are torn, despising both Swamy's column and the way he was relieved of his duties. And the usually outspoken Swamy, who has made few public comments on the issue, save a few Twitter postings, is finally firing back. Quote, "I was surprised Harvard would do this, given that the president's office said free speech was sacred," he said in an interview. "The people who cut me out are leftists who have nothing to do with economics," like any leftists do. "There's no allegation that in my class I said anything offensive. There's no allegation that it has affected my research. It's almost like the Spanish Inquisition. They didn't give me a chance." No one, including Swamy, disputes that the column, which appeared in the English language Daily News and Analysis, is provocative. Now listen closely to this right here. Published after a terror bombing in India, it lays out a strategy, quote, "to negate the political goals of Islamic terrorism in India." Listen closely. "Provided the Muslim community fail to condemn these goals and call them un-Islamic," unquote. That's like some super important context, isn't it? Among its suggestions, remove an iconic mosque from the site of a Hindu temple and 300 others in other sites as a tit for tat. Declare that only those non-Hindus can vote if they proudly acknowledge that their ancestors are Hindus, and enact a national law prohibiting conversion from Hindu religion to any other religion. So yeah, okay, very ugly views as far as I'm concerned, but there was a qualifier there. "We will go to these reactionary measures if the Muslim community doesn't condemn these attacks." So it sounds almost like a rhetorical device to me. Potentially shocking words, but Swamy said he believed that they have been misconstrued. Was he advocating the destruction of mosques? Not exactly, he said. Quote, "I said if they threw bombs at our temples, we could restore the temples they demolished earlier on." Did he want to keep Muslims from voting? "No," he said. "I was searching for a way to unite Hindus and Muslims. Based on DNA research, we are descended from the same ancestors. I said that if you do not acknowledge that your ancestors are Hindu, you are identifying with those who came from outside. And for them, we created Pakistan." Yikes. To Swamy, these are reasonable points. To Diana Eck, the comparative religion professor who introduced the motion to cancel Swamy's courses, they are an open incitement to violence. Quote, "He begins by talking about fanatic Muslims and proceeds to suggest means of remedy that would infect the entire Muslim population of India," she said. "That's not an alternative side of a heated political discussion. That's advocating the abrogation of human rights." Since the meeting, X inbox has been flooded by Swamy's allies. They accuse her of issuing a fatwa. Some call for the president to fire her. Oh, God, does every angry person want everyone in academia to be fired all the time? Others blame the president herself for the mess. Dr. Faust, president of Harvard's name is Dr. Faust, will not be welcome in India, one emailer wrote. Eck and her colleagues also have critics who disapprove of what Swamy said, but defend his right to say it. Among them is Harry Lewis, the former dean of Harvard College, who serves as its loyal opposition. Swami's column does not fit the legal definition of incitement, he said. It does not seem to have incited any violence. It was political speech, he said, the kind often most in need of protection. More importantly, Lewis said, the back-channel way which Swami was dismissed sets a precedent that could be used against any professor who offends. If you create a weapon, Lewis said, the weapon will eventually be used against you. But Eck called concerns about a slippery slope ridiculous. The faculty course approval process, she said, applies only to summer school, and use of it in this manner is so rare that no one could remember another instance. The school's administration has been silent on the case since July, and it remains so, declining requests for comment. For his part, Swami has moved on. He has no plans to sue Harvard. Actually, he said, he loves the school, where he has studied and taught on and off since 1962. He will not be seeking an academic position elsewhere. It's Harvard or nothing, he said. Final note, there was a profile of Swami written for The Caravan, a journal of politics and culture. The name of the piece is The Outlier, The Inscrutable Politics of Subramanian Swami. Here's an excerpt. In the classroom, though, Swami seems to have been uniformly impressive. Shahid Javed Berkey, who had taken Swami's mathematical economics class in 1967 and become fast friends with his professor, told me that Swami was an extremely good teacher. He was very well spoken of, and he was very popular, said Berkey, who went on to become a caretaker finance minister of Pakistan. Panini recalls hearing Swami deliver lectures at the Indian Institute of Technology in Delhi in the early 1970s. Quote, he was brilliant. He had a very neat and sharp mind and a capacity to analyze things and put them across in a systematic, convincing way, unquote. One of his former teaching assistants during the summer gig at Harvard a few years ago, who asked that her name be withheld, told me that Swami was really enthusiastic. The class was called Economic Development in India and East Asia, and Swami, she said, had an anecdotal teaching style. He'd tell lots of stories about his experience with government, and he was always generous with his time. He was definitely the smartest person in the room. At the end of the term, he hosted a dinner at the Bombay Club in Harvard Square. Most professors don't do things like that for undergraduates. So I'm sorry, where was I? Oh yeah, paragraph 7 of Sandra Korn's article, where she says, 2 years ago, when former summer school instructor Subramanian Swami published hateful commentary about Muslims in India, the Harvard community organized to ensure that he would not return to teach on campus, a nice open and shut kind of thing there. I consider that sort of organizing both appropriate and commendable. Perhaps it should even be applied more broadly. Okay, so now a broader application of what was done to Swami, right? The very thing that Diana Eck, the comparative religion professor in the last article, referred to as a ridiculous slippery slope argument. 2 years later, you've got a student calling for it to become policy in the Harvard Crimson. Sorry, again, where was I? Perhaps it should even be applied more broadly. Does government professor Harvey Mansfield have a legal right to publish a book in which he claims that, quote, to resist rape, a woman needs ellipses, a certain ladylike modesty, unquote? Well, God knows what's in that ellipses. Well, I'm not going to redo what I just did with Subramanian to fill that ellipses, but we can guess that there's something in it, right? I'm sorry, again, let me take that line again. Don't try to pick up some momentum here with reading. Does government professor Harvey Mansfield have the legal right to publish a book in which he claims that, quote, to resist rape, a woman needs ellipses, a certain ladylike modesty, unquote? Probably. Do I think he should do that? No. And I would happily organize with other feminists on campus to stop him from publishing further sexist commentary. It's all the labeling you need. Under the authority of a Harvard faculty position. Academic freedom, which he continuously puts these things in quotes for no reason. I'm going to start using my Larry the Liberal voice. We're renaming him. He's now Larry the Leftist. Academic freedom might permit such an offensive view of rape to be published. Academic justice would not. Over winter break, Harvard published a statement responding to the American Studies Association's resolution to boycott Israeli academic institutions until Israel ends its occupation of Palestine. Oh, the perils of collectivism. We will punish all things Israeli until the Israeli government behaves better. That is literally like ISIS logic right there. Much of the conversation on this academic boycott is focused around academic freedom. Opponents of the boycott claim it restricts the freedom of Israeli academics or interrupts the free flow of ideas. Proponents of the boycott often argue that the boycott is intended to, in the end, increase, not restrict, academic freedom. The ASA, that's American Studies Association, points out that, quote, there is no effective or substantive economic freedom for Palestinian students and scholars under conditions of Israeli occupation. So are there any limits to that rule being made there that all things Israeli can justifiably be punished because there's an Israeli occupation of Palestine? And is it possible that at some point in the future, Sandra, these things could take up the attention of the school in a way that detracts from the educational experience of people who are actually there to learn? Don't make ridiculous slippery slope arguments, Brett. Well, this from the Harvard Political Review, about a year and a half after Sandra Korn wrote her piece. Some of you are going to say, Brett, you made that up. It's linked in the show notes. There's an impression on campus that Harvard might be the exception to the seemingly radical changes regarding freedom of expression on campuses. Unfortunately, this is not the case. Last year, for example, a Palestinian student group pointed out that the college used water machines made by the Israeli company SodaStream. Consequently, the Harvard administration removed the machines. When some students heard about this, they became enraged that the college would even consider removing machines simply because they came from Israel. In response to this outcry, the machines were placed back in the dining areas, brand labels removed. I shit you not! Back to Sandra. In this case, discourse about academic freedom obscures what should fundamentally be a political argument. Those defending the academic boycott should use a more rigorous standard. The ASA, which is again American Studies Association, like three other academic associations, decided to boycott out of a sense of social justice, responding to a call by Palestinian civil society organizations for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions until Israel ends its occupation of Palestine. People on the right opposed to boycotts can play the freedom game, calling for economic freedom to buy any product or academic freedom to associate with any institution. Only those who care about justice can take the moral upper hand. And that is such a central idea. This is why people like Sandra think that they sit at the adults' table of political discourse. They have the moral upper hand because their fight is for justice. And we're getting to that. We're almost done. It is tempting to decry frustrating restrictions on academic research as violations of academic freedom, this time not in quotes. Yet I would encourage student and worker organizers to instead use a framework of justice. After all, if we give up our obsessive reliance on the doctrine of academic justice, we can consider more thoughtfully what is just. The end. Sure, yeah, consider more thoughtfully what is just. Maybe in your next article, you could even fucking define it for us, Sandra, since you didn't do that here. Now, there's one line in Sandra Korn's piece that I want to attend to specifically. If our university community opposes racism, sexism, and heterosexism, why should we put up with research that counters our goals simply in the name of academic freedom? Well, that assumes a lot, doesn't it? It assumes that you have power ideologically within the institution. And right now, people like that, I would say that's fair. I think they do. They are in power because they're getting these attitudes from professors, by and large. So in other words, these are unhealthy ideas. These are malformed, bad ideas. Why should we be giving them any attention? You know, I contrast that to my experience doing this show. When I was very naive 6 or 7 years ago, I wanted nothing more than to give the ideas that I thought were unhealthy or malformed attention. I would just get banned from one teacher forum after another, just asking to have discussions with people about public schooling. Now, I was naive then in a lot of ways, and I think that I had more confidence in my beliefs, in my philosophy then, than I do now. But confidence in what you believe, it usually shows up in the world as like a desire to have discourse with people who disagree with you. I find myself in my private time questioning many things that I put intellectual stock in the past. It's an exercise that I feel is really, really valuable, but at times extremely discomforting. When I realized, like, if I wanted to be an expert on something like the trivium, the path that lies ahead for me to do that is very, very daunting. And I find myself auditing a lot of beliefs. This will come up on this show in the future. But I have a need to speak with confidence and clarity. And I think I have a high enough opinion of myself that I'm not afraid of being proven wrong. Even in this forum, I mean, that's good for this forum. You know, I should actually interject this. We've had this critic of the show. He's an academic. And he has been posting for about a year. He originally was somebody who wanted to be on the show. And that, for a number of reasons, I don't want to get into it. It didn't go well. He wasn't somebody that I wanted to have an extended conversation with. I didn't find him very likable at all. But his knowledge on a lot of the subjects that we were covering far surpassed mine, specifically on the trivium. So I found myself in this balance of like, well, this is really somebody who we could get a lot from, but I just don't want to talk to him. And that makes me feel like a bit of a hypocrite. So I'm going to tell you about him, and you can go interact with him if you want. He has a blog where he devotes a lot of space to criticizing what we do here at School Sucks Podcast and what a lot of our media friends do at places like Tragedy and Hope. The URL is Funky Eds, that's funkyeds.blogspot.hk. You could use search terms like School Sucks. And another one that he likes to use is Trivium Cult. So if you put those two things into the search, you could find lots of articles about the work we've done and his problems with it. But I was even less encouraged about interacting with this person when I realized that his idea was that what we do at School Sucks Project is essentially a cult. Now, I don't want to poison the well. Because there's lots of valuable educational material on his blog. I'm just telling you why I wasn't interested in having an interaction with this person. If somebody says that what you do has no value, but they obsessively listen to every episode and then try to craft like a really scathing, attention-grabbing comment about that episode, largely built on the idea that he knows more about the subject than I do, like, one of the reasons why I walked away from what I was doing, or one of the benefits of walking away from what I used to do into doing this, is that I don't have to interact with anybody that I don't want to, you know? And that sounds like a way to build a fence to keep critics out. But like, this experience made me realize why people get blocked. I mean, this is the only person that I've ever blocked from the School Sucks site. So I was talking to somebody who helps me with the site, and they said, why do you let this guy post there? I said, why wouldn't I let him post there? I haven't even approved all his comments. Like, there's some comments that he wrote that I don't even approve. All the comments have to go through moderation. And this person said, stop. He's just linking to his blog from your site. So you're putting out these like kind of baseless insults, you know, that you're a huckster, that you're running a cult. And then he links to his blog, which is hurting your SEO. So you're basically hurting your SEO to let somebody insult you on your site. You shouldn't do that. So I blocked him from the site. But if you're interested in criticisms of what we do, if you want a challenge, It's funkyeds.blogspot.hk. And while he has said things like, you know, you need to do a better job understanding universal grammar and deep structure, which is a kind of a linguistic subset. If you've read Chomsky beyond Chomsky's political stuff, you probably have some awareness of deep structure. But his communication skills are so poor, it's hard for me to consider like giving him a place on the show to demonstrate his authority on those topics. So it's an interesting problem that I haven't talked about publicly. But as I'm saying this, as I'm criticizing these people, I do understand the impulse to build barriers. So just another excerpt from that Harvard Political Review piece where I pulled the thing about the SodaStream Israeli water machines. There's this paragraph. If the college seeks to attain the kind of diversity of thought seen on a national scale, then the singularity of opinion on campus should be seen as a warning. The fact that students are so in line should demonstrate that there is a barrier, and that is a force holding it in place. For the most part, this is student-driven. Not only should it be explicitly allowed for students to deviate from the norm, if someone's views differ from those of his peers, it should be encouraged for him to talk freely about it, foremost with fellow students. It is only through these conversations that this talented student body can truly learn. I can totally relate to this, to that, you know, that need to make meaning that we all have, especially when we're focused on knowledge pursuits, especially when it's public, what we're doing. You know, I spent all this time trying to make sense of this old book that I'm going to talk about in a few minutes earlier today, while there's 50 important emails waiting for me in my inbox. Like I, and maybe you, am compelled to take shortcuts in my thinking, to not be as thorough as I should. And when easy answers appear, especially for these people in academia, well, yeah, I can relate. Like, here's knowledge, just grab this knowledge and go with it. It's coming from Harvard professors. You don't need to take the day off to explore the ideological roots of these propositions. Just embrace them, knowing that they came from somebody smarter than you. Who is not guilty of that? I think there's a distinction, though. Even as I admit guilt in the past, none of the propositions that I've embraced, even at times uncritically, led to the suggestion that force should be imposed on other people. I think that that's an important distinction, if I can defend myself. But that's something that I've worked very hard on this year. And it will hopefully continue to show up on the show in the future. So I don't want to condemn somebody for their lack of rigor alone. But in this case, it's much more than that. And just to compare the two different settings, right? Like with what we do here, or even places that have, you know, reputations for banning more users than just one, like Free Domain Radio comes to mind. I think there's some understanding that people are trusted to do their own research. That if anything, these types of platforms, these types of conversations are just jumping off points. You know, that's what bothered me so much about being called a cult leader. Like, that's just so bizarre, knowing how I present myself and conduct myself in this show. A college is slightly different because we don't anticipate that people are going to come to platforms like this that are really, in many ways, rooted in the philosophy of liberty, with a blind trust for authority. But students who cruise through high school getting straight A's and get into Harvard University or some other Ivy League school or any other school that's plagued with these social justice problems right now, they are much more likely than the audience here to embrace ideas of collectivism and authoritarianism, especially a kind of intellectual authoritarianism. And what kinds of messages do these policies send to students at these universities? Like, you would think that if a student gets into a place like Harvard, there would be an expectation that they could handle challenging discourse, especially when it comes to furthering their educational experience and their knowledge. But when you start walking through the halls of a place like this and you see these colorful rainbow triangles that say safe zone on them, that communicates something else entirely, right? This is a place where you're safe from the things that offend you. inside you will find what is right and what is just. And I have to say, you know, from what I observe in social media, there's a lot of libertarians who are afflicted by this same problem. The attitude that they present to other people that they engage in arguments with on Facebook and Twitter. I am right, and you are dumb and dangerous. If you find yourself in that situation where you're presenting that way, or you feel yourself having that affect, that indignation, think Sandra Korn. It's like a kind of safe word for more peaceful discourse. This is one of the reasons why we've stressed communication, even if we haven't gotten everything right on the topic of communication, why we've tried to put it under a spotlight. There has to be not just a willingness, in my opinion, but an excitement to engage the people who we believe have bad ideas, but to do it constructively. So we see the tact that is becoming all too typical on America's college campuses. Instead of subjecting ideas to tests or to counter evidence and people being forced to explain what and why they believe certain things, all in an effort to not only become better informed, but also to become better defenders of good ideas. Instead, we see people being cornered and screamed at and then no platformed. And that's academic authoritarianism. Beyond the colleges, we see this with like hate speech laws, right? Same exact thing. There's this faulty idea that words can actually harm people. And censorship is justified, especially by the guardians, especially by those at the philosophical political adults table, as a form of harm reduction. And this is how we bring about justice. So let's talk about the word justice. Let's start with this concept of academic justice. I mean, we would think that that would mean the best ideas win, right? So ideas, conflicting ideas, subjected to testing, subjected to reason and empiricism, and certain things emerge as the best ideas. How seemingly just. But then we have this societal justice, which is really what Sandra Korn is talking about when she says academic. It's what promotes social justice. And attempts to achieve it have actually, ironically, not that Sandra cares, encouraged new types of injustice. In her book, Philosophy, Who Needs It?, written in 1984, Ayn Rand gave a warning. The new theory of justice, in quotes, demands that men counteract the injustice of nature by instituting the most obscenely unthinkable injustice among men. Deprive those favored by nature, for example, the talented, the intelligent, the creative, of the right to the rewards they produce, for example, the right to life. That might be a little extreme. And grant to the incompetent, the stupid, the slothful, a right to the effortless enjoyment of the rewards they could not produce, could not imagine, and would not know what to do with. Gosh, that's pretty harsh, isn't it? And of course, in this philosophical conversation, Ayn Rand is so fringe. The real articulations of what justice is needs to come from the adults table, right? At places like Harvard University. So let's leave Sandra Korn in 2014 and jump back 45 years to Harvard of the early 1970s. And a professor named John Rawls. So this is why much earlier in the discussion, I mentioned the problem with how nebulous the word justice is. Justice has been the topic of philosophical debates that go back to ancient Greece, if not before. So it is quite startling to contemplate that a 21-year-old gender studies major at Harvard University might have discovered an objective definition of justice, one that can be enforced by those people similar in mind to Sandra Korn in positions of power. And remember, because of the insularity of these environments, people who propose a system like that and its enforcements often have a difficult time imagining that people holding institutional power, you know, other academic authoritarians, could have opinions or values that were much different from their own. So it's pretty safe. But at that point, it becomes a self-refuting idea, because it means injustice for some. The promotion of this conception of justice, which a 21-year-old has discovered, means the acceptance of injustice for others. How much has public opinion changed in the last 50 years? How much is it going to change in the next 50 years? Remember that comment much earlier in the show about the weapon that might be used against you someday? If you accept and embrace the idea that the academic system is justified in regulating speech and thought, do you couple that with the confidence, the certainty even, that your adults' table positions and ideas will still be the most treasured 50 years from now? How about this? How many examples are there of things happening today that you would consider steps towards justice that would once have been categorized, maybe 40, 50, 60 years ago, as offensive or intolerable speech? What if in 1965 you said, "I don't have a problem with two dudes getting married"? Well, in the mind of the intellectual establishment, the academic authoritarians, shame on you. In a couple of conversations that we've had about the alt-right, we talked about the pendulum of power and extremism swinging back and forth. It swings. My comment to those who support Donald Trump as an equal and opposite response to these shenanigans of leftists: how hard does that pendulum swing back the other way? Equal and opposite reactions don't just go in the favor of one group of extremists. So it's interesting how this concept of justice that's put forward in that article — I know we returned to the article, I'm getting back to 1970, is actually self-detonating, self-refuting. It's a stolen concept. The great value is justice. To ensure it inquires injustice. What a mess. So anyway, back to John Rawls. He wrote a book in 1971 while teaching at Harvard University called The Theory of Justice. I'm going to read for you parts of a summary from the Critical Survey of Literature for Students. John Rawls, a philosopher who held the James Bryan Conant University Professorship at Harvard University, published several books and many articles. He is chiefly known, however, for his book A Theory of Justice, an effort to define social justice. The work has greatly influenced modern political thought, damn straight. Rawls was dissatisfied with the traditional philosophical arguments about what makes a social institution just, and about what justifies political or social actions and policies. The utilitarian argument holds that societies should pursue the greatest good for the greatest number. This argument has a number of problems, including especially that it seems to be consistent with the idea of tyranny of majorities over minorities. The intuitionist argument holds that humans intuit what is right and wrong by some innate moral sense. This is also problematic because it simply explains away justice by saying that people know it when they see it, maybe people like Sandra Korn, and it fails to deal with the many conflicting human intuitions. Rawls attempts to establish a reasoned account of social justice through the social contract approach. This approach holds that a society is in some sense an agreement among all those within that society. If a society were an agreement, Rawls asks, what kind of arrangement would everyone agree to? He states that the contract is purely a hypothetical one. He does not argue that people had existed outside the social state or had made agreements to establish a particular type of society. Rawls begins his work with the idea of justice as fairness. He identifies the basic structure of society as the primary subject of justice and identifies justice as the first virtue of social institutions. He considers justice a matter of the organization and the internal divisions of a society. The main idea of A Theory of Justice asks, what kind of organization of society would rational persons choose if they were in an initial position of independence and equality and were setting up a system of cooperation? This is what Rawls sees as a hypothetical original position. the state in which no one knows what place he or she would occupy in the society to be created. So in other words, what would they choose? What kind of safety would they guarantee for themselves in that state of ignorance? And therefore, that's what will be applied to all people, hypothetically, of course. After considering the main characteristics of justice as fairness and the theoretical superiority of this approach to utilitarianism, intuitionism, or other perspectives, Rawls looks at principles of justice. He identifies two principles, one that each person should have equal rights to the most extensive liberties consistent with other people enjoying the same liberties, and two, that inequalities should be arranged so that they would be to everyone's advantage and arranged so that no one person would be blocked from occupying any position. From these two principles, Rawls derives an egalitarian conception of justice that would allow the inequality of conditions implied by equality of opportunity, but would also give more attention to those born with fewer assets and less favorable social positions. Maybe you'd never heard of John Rawls, but this is probably starting to sound familiar. Rawls concludes the first part of the book by looking at the idea of the original position outside society. This hypothetical original position can be approximated by using the thought experiment of the veil of ignorance. If no one could know what place he or she would occupy in the society being formed, what arrangement of the society would a rational person choose? Rawls maintains that the choice would be a social structure that would best benefit the unknowing chooser if he or she happened to end up in the least desirable position. In the second part of the book, the good part, the exciting part, Rawls considers the implications of his view of justice for social institutions. He discusses in detail equal liberty, economic distribution, duties and obligations, as well as the main characteristics of each that would make up a just society. He does not, however, identify any particular type of social or political system that would be consistent with his theory. He deals only with the demands that his version of justice places on institutions. In a third and final section, Rawls deals with the ultimate goals of thinking about social justice. He argues for the need to have a theory of goodness, and he makes the case for seeing goodness as rationality. He then turns to moral psychology and considers how people acquire a sentiment of justice. Finally, he examines the good of justice, how justice is connected to goodness. Rawls argues that in a well-ordered society, ideas of goodness and justice must be consistent with each other. Now, Rawls, who was quite bright, understood the potential for this to be the whole justice versus liberty thing to have that self-detonation potential. He wrote, "Each person possesses an inviolability founded on justice that even the welfare of society as a whole cannot override." Even though this has some echoes of things we've talked about on the show before, like Jeremy Bentham and utilitarianism and the greatest happiness for the greatest number. There's lots of like Lockean social contract stuff here too, but what he's saying is, I can do one better. Each person possesses an inviolability founded on justice that even the welfare of society as a whole cannot override. For this reason, justice denies that the loss of freedom for some is made right by a greater good shared by others. So that seems to solve a problem that would put him completely at odds with libertarianism. The problem is, it's all completely unrealistic because the world already exists. So if you embrace Rawls' ideas, how do you bring them into reality? It's like that old Einstein thing where he talked about motivation and the perseverance to get through difficult problems. Well, sometimes I envision the end, and this is something that I've embraced and something that I've liked, but not in the case of John Rawls. Sometimes you envision the end that you want first. You see the results, you imagine them. And even though the path might seem incredibly difficult between where you actually are and where you envision yourself, imagining the end as a source of motivation can sometimes clear the path in between. So in the early 1970s, John Rawls says, here's how things should be. And many left-wing ideologues go through academia, never getting a balanced perspective, maybe never encountering the criticisms of Rawls. And they say, yeah, John, things fucking should be that way. It's pretty dangerous, right? That exciting vision of the future is pretty dangerous when it's coupled with like Marxist-Leninist political tactics. But that kind of explains how we, and let me know if you think I'm stretching, I think that kind of explains the current situation in academia and beyond. It's at least a factor. So Rawls argues from this original position of equality, right? But we don't start at original position. So the only way to achieve it is the illogical maximization of opportunities for some people. In other words, providing opportunities for people who can't meet those opportunities or don't fit those opportunities. The minimization of opportunities for other people and the mass redistribution of resources. That's the prescription. Financial, social, educational, etc. So good in theory, good in practice? Nope, because good theories are practicable. And in practice, this concept of justice is self-refuting. So just for the sake of clarity, Rawls is talking about an equal distribution of resources, and this is what is desirable. Unfortunately, based on the world that is already, maybe he was in the ivory tower at Harvard University. Maybe nobody told him the world was already there outside of it, but it was. And there's no way that that ideal can be achieved, you know, providing these benefits for disadvantaged people without some form of injustice taking place. So libertarians would say, yeah, if people make things, they have the right to the things they make. So you enter into a condition of injustice every time you talk about, every time you think about or make policy towards leveling the playing field, because you have people who have the intelligence or the motivation or the skill to produce things engaged in a state of involuntary servitude. They are deprived of products, wealth, and opportunities due to them as a result of their time, knowledge, and effort. That's how it plays in the real world. So, sure, Rawls would sound all warm and fuzzy and great if you've never read anything about the philosophy of liberty. And if you're a student at Harvard University, well, you probably haven't. Now, what I'm leaving out of this show, massive amounts of debate, even intra-libertarian debate on the merits of John Rawls. So Robert Nozick, who was a colleague of Rawls at Harvard, wrote in 1974, Anarchy, State, and Utopia. But through that initial response, it started this long and elaborate conversation where justice and freedom were in many ways pitted against each other. Therefore, we could fall into a trap I've certainly fallen into before, especially with someone like Immanuel Kant, who is cast as a bad guy because of what his ideas became. The big problem with Rawls in A Theory of Justice is he doesn't give any examples of what a just society is. So it's very vague and it's left wide open for interpretation by different types of ideologues. So you might have proponents of, you know, free market capitalism. This is like a pretty standard Republican talking point. Like, no system has uplifted the poor like capitalism. Even people who do not reap, you know, the greatest rewards of the capitalist system, their quality of life is higher than it would have been in a non-capitalist system. So this is an economic system aligns better with Rawls' idea of justice than what we would see in some place like the Soviet Union, where everybody is poor and desperate. But others would use Rawls to say, yes, this is an ideal we should strive for, and we should do it by the opposite means. We should have a, you know, super level the playing field redistributionist economy because that creates the most economic equality. So that's a criticism of A Theory of Justice, is that it doesn't give a clear idea of what institutions or societies are, you know, favorable at the time the book was written, and therefore it leaves things very open to interpretation. But where is the book widely distributed? Through academia. So what kinds of systems do you think are going to be paired with it? Free market capitalism? Libertarianism? Are you nuts? No, in that environment, they are paired with left-wing ideologies. I mean, equality and fairness. They've, you know, at least rhetorically, they've had the market cornered on that since like the middle of the 1800s. So I don't want to demonize the man, John Rawls, because of how his ideas were used or even perverted. But considering how things have played out over the last 50 years, he is like one of the founding fathers of the social justice movement. A beautiful vision of a future utopia for the young and naive, schooled to embrace the political tactics of by any means necessary. Watch out. There's a lot more we could discuss about this, and I don't mean to have an anticlimactic ending. If you have thoughts on the show, please go ahead and post them in the Facebook group. I'd love your feedback, and this could certainly be an expanding conversation. If you have suggestions for related topics or related guests, I'd love to hear from you. Also, please don't forget to support us on Patreon. There is a link right in the show notes. You just click on it, and you can sign up to contribute $1 per content item. I got my first lump sum payment from Patreon a few days ago. I immediately unhooked the custom build computer that I have, and I sent it in for much needed repairs. I'm also upgrading the memory, so when it comes back, I should have a better performing machine, and I might even be able to do a couple of new things that I'm excited about. So thank you so much for your support, and I look forward to your feedback. I'm going to leave you today with a somewhat heated exchange between economist Milton Friedman and a college student in what I'm guessing from the video is the late 1970s, in an attempt to bring to life some of the ideas that we have discussed in this show today. Juxtapose what you're about to hear with my explanations of John Rawls and a theory of justice. And juxtapose what you're about to hear with that bizarre opening scene in this show, something that to many of you probably seems so ridiculous. Thanks again, everybody, and I hope this show helps you in your future conversations and debates on these very, very challenging subjects. Take care.
You say that you believe many people in America believe in your definition of freedom from coercion, and I might agree with you, but I also believe that many people in America believe in a different kind of freedom, and that is freedom to well-being, a certain level of standards, fair housing at a good price, education, etc. The other thing I want to say is that the system has built into it the poor remain poor and the rich remain rich, and that is an externality of the system.
It is not built into the system at all. It has never been true. It's simply a false. If you look at the evidence, there is an enormous amount of mobility from one class to the other.
It is not immediately easy to become in the wealthy class. There are certain parts of the system which make that virtually impossible for the real person. Now, I believe that this freedom, too, represents the belief in equality as opposed to liberty. And I wonder, is it possible to build a system based on this equality, which I believe that many people agree in, and would not be willing to sacrifice to the liberty of freedom from?
Well, I'm not going to be able to give a full answer to your question because you've asked a very, very complex question, and so you're going to have to pardon me if I am a little dogmatic, but I only want to suggest that the statements I'm making are not without some thought and reason behind them. In my opinion, a society that aims for equality before liberty will end up with neither equality nor liberty. And a society that aims first for liberty will not end up with equality, but it will end up with a closer approach to equality than any other kind of system that has ever been developed. Now, that conclusion is based both on evidence from history, across history, and also, I believe, on reasoning which, if you try to follow through the implications of aiming first at equality, will become clear to you. You can only aim at equality by giving some people the right to take things from others. And what ultimately happens when you aim at equality is that A and B decide what C shall do for D. Except that they take a little bit of a commission off on the way.